even seems confused about the lies he's telling.
Let's talk about this lawsuit against Hillary Clinton. What do you hope to accomplish with that?
Well, they spied on my campaign. You had all of them there.
Remember, there is still no proof that anybody spied on his campaign.
All the names are there, all the names you've been reading about for years. Bill Barr didn't want to be impeached, and so therefore he decided not to do it, which was a shame because, frankly, you know, you need courage to fight these people, deep state or whatever you want to call them. But
Trump still talking about the deep state. I mean, fully in to so many of these different conspiracy theories.
I think we're going to do very well with it. We have a great lawsuit, and I felt it was really very important to bring it because think of it. If I spied on their campaign, can you imagine what would happen, John?
Now, remember, the lawsuit, as we talked about yesterday, will go nowhere. If the lawsuit were to proceed, Trump would be subject to discovery. And the last thing Trump would ever allow is for himself to be put under oath and deposed. It's just the lawsuit's going nowhere. You guys know that.
Spied on their campaign on Obama or Biden or on Hillary Clinton. And the same thing happened where we caught him because we caught him red handed. If that ever happened, what are they talking about? Treason? Are they talking about the rest of your life in jail? Are they talking about death penalty? And these people can't be allowed to get away with this stuff.
Right. So Trump suggesting that something that didn't happen is actually treason. Trump then seemingly blaming Joe Biden for Putin maybe using nukes. I mean, this is bizarre stuff.
Let's also talk about Russia and Ukraine. Seems like Putin may have miscalculated there. What is your assessment of where things stand right now with Putin's invasion of Ukraine?
Well, you never know. I can tell you the country is just in shambles. You look at these cities, they've been bombed and they've been blown up, and it's going to take 50 to 100 years to rebuild them. And so many people have been killed. So many people have been killed and horribly wounded. But I will tell you that it should have never happened. This would have never happened had the election not been rigged. This would have never happened. He would have never in a million years have done it. So it's very sad. When I watch it, it's sad because this is something all those people should be living now. They should not be dead.
Do you think Putin would use nuclear weapons?
When you put him into a corner and when you talk the way they're talking, you know, they're talking weak and yet they're almost giving him an incentive. It's they're handling him very badly, in my opinion. I think that Biden apologized again today. He's apologized every time he makes a speech. He apologizes 3-4 times a day for everything he says. Look, we have people that don't know what they're doing.
Yeah. So anyway, if Putin uses nuclear weapons, it is not going to be Joe Biden's fault. And then lastly, Trump commenting on approval ratings.
I have no idea if he's going to run. I can't imagine he does well. He's got the lowest approval rating in history, in the history of a president, which is pretty low. And if he does, and if I decide, I'd love to run against him, I can tell you. Who would be better?
Now, of course, Donald Trump's approval ratings at this point in his presidency were lower than those of Joe Biden. So quite literally all lies. It's lies all the way down. And Trump just is seeming very confused when you look at him and when you listen to him. It's all very bizarre. We have a voicemail number. That number is 2192-DAVID-P. Our friend Billy Harrison called in. He really thinks Keystone XL would lower gas prices. Listen to this.
David Pacman.
Yeah.
Billy Harrison again. You're saying President Biden, or any president for that matter, has nothing to do with the price of gas.
Almost nothing to do. I've explained the three things presidents can do.
So, I've called you several times to debate. Seems like you never play my clips.
I actually have played a number of Billy's clips.
My voicemail on your show. I wouldn't either if I was you because I'd make you look stupid.
Right.
But, Mr. President has nothing to do with gas prices. Yet, Joe Biden, first day in office, counts the Keystone Pipeline. That's one way he affects the gas prices.
Yeah. No, unfortunately, that's not true. Remember, Keystone Pipeline phases 1 through 3 are up and running. What Joe Biden did was stop construction of the fourth phase of Keystone XL. Keystone is not an oil field. It's only a pipeline. It's a way to transport the oil. The oil is still coming in. It's just coming in through other means. And the best estimates we have are that phase 4 of Keystone XL, when completed, and it wouldn't even be done now, if Biden had started continued construction, it wouldn't even be done now. But when completed, phase four of Keystone XL would only have increased oil production by 1%, would have no impact on the price of gas. Sorry, Billy. We've got a great bonus show for you today. Sign up at joinpacman.com to get in.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Signals we hear from the negotiating platform positive, but these signals do not drown out the blows of Russian shells.
As the outlines of a possible peace deal emerge, Ukraine has offered to become a neutral country and remain nuclear free in exchange for security guarantees. But Ukrainian officials say a deal can only be reached once Russia withdraws its forces. We'll go to Kyiv to speak with Peter Zalmayev, director of the Eurasia Democracy Initiative. Then, as the U.S. announces it'll welcome up to 100,000 Ukrainian refugees fleeing the Russian invasion, immigration officials say they're preparing for a surge of migrants and increasing detentions at the U.S.-Mexico border. We'll speak with Ghislaine Joseph of the Haitian Bridge Alliance about how Haitian refugees are treated, and with award-winning journalist Marina Hossa about the Haitians she met in a migrant caravan.
In the U.S. media, they're portrayed like they're forcing their way into the United States or trying to intimidate Americans. But in fact, what I see is a very different narrative of a caravan. This is a caravan of love, safety, and security.
We'll also look at how the Western world has turned its back on the horrific conditions African migrants face in, among other places, inside Libyan detention centers, documented in a new book by Sally Hayden called My Fourth Time, We Drowned, Seeking Refuge on the World's Deadliest Migration Route. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations says more than 4 million refugees have now fled Ukraine as Russia's invasion nears its sixth week. On Tuesday, Russia announced plans to, quote, fundamentally cut back military operations near Kyiv and the city of Chernihiv, but the claim was greeted by deep skepticism from Ukraine. Officials in Chernihiv say Russian forces carried out strikes through the night while air raid sirens repeatedly went off in Kyiv. On Tuesday, at least 12 people died and 33 were injured in the southern city of Mykolaiv after a Russian rocket hit a government building, leaving a gaping hole in the nine-story structure. Meanwhile, Human Rights Watch has accused Russia of using banned anti-personnel landmines in the eastern Kharkiv region. This comes as the outlines of a possible peace deal have emerged. Ukraine has offered to become a neutral country and remain nuclear-free in exchange for security guarantees. But Ukrainian officials said a deal could only be reached once Russia withdraws its forces.
So, in order for this agreement to be valid and for all sides to agree on it, there has to be full peace on Ukraine's territory. No foreign troops. All have to leave.
CNN is reporting U.S. troops in Poland are providing weapons instruction to Ukrainian soldiers as the Biden administration continues to funnel anti-tank missiles, machine guns, grenade launchers, and drones into Ukraine. President Biden hinted at the training efforts Monday.
We're talking about helping train the troops in that are the Ukrainian troops that are in Poland.
A top UN official in Ukraine is calling for a probe into Ukrainian and Russian forces mistreating prisoners of war. One widely circulated video appears to show Ukrainian soldiers shooting 3 hooded Russians in their legs. The video also shows Ukrainian soldiers kicking and hitting the captive Russians, some of whom are bleeding. In other news, the CDC and FDA have given approval for a second COVID-19 booster shot for all adults in the United States 50 years old and older. The FDA also okayed a second booster for many younger people who have certain immune deficiencies. On Tuesday, the House Oversight Committee held its first hearing on Medicare for All since the start of the pandemic. Speakers included the lawyer and healthcare activist Adi Barkin, who was diagnosed with terminal ALS in 2016. He testified from his home using a computerized system that tracks his eye movements and turns them into spoken words.
It's shameful that in the richest country in the world, we choose to inflict so much suffering. Since that first hearing about Medicare for All, our country has been through the worst public health crisis in a century. The pandemic has revealed and exacerbated the existing inequalities in our profit-driven healthcare system. It has hit hardest on disabled people, poor people, Black, Latino, and Indigenous people, and especially people who live at the intersections of these categories. And one out of three COVID-19 deaths in the U.S. are related to gaps in health insurance. Nearly a million Americans have already died from the coronavirus. How much more is necessary to shock our legislators into action?
In international news, 8 United Nations peacekeepers died Tuesday in the Democratic Republic of Congo after their helicopter crashed. The Congolese army accused the rebel group M23 of shooting down the helicopter. This comes as the UN reports nearly 2,300 Congolese civilians have been killed in the first 3 months of the year in eastern Congo. In news from Afghanistan, the World Bank suspended 4 projects worth $600 million after the Taliban announced public high schools will remain closed to girls. In recent days, the Taliban has issued a number of new rules. Women have been barred from flying without a male chaperone. Men and women will no longer be allowed in public parks on the same day. And all male government workers must grow beards or risk being fired. Israeli authorities say a Palestinian man from the occupied West Bank shot dead 5 people in the Israeli city of B'nai Brak outside Tel Aviv Tuesday before he was fatally shot. It was the 3rd deadly attack inside Israel over the past week. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas condemned Tuesday's attack, saying, quote, "The cycle of violence confirms that a comprehensive, just, and stable peace is the shortest, most correct path to security and stability for both peoples," Abbas said. In El Salvador, President Nayib Bukele says authorities have arrested over 2,000 people since a state of emergency was imposed following a violent weekend. Police say they're targeting suspected members of gangs by cordoning off entire neighborhoods and conducting house-by-house searches. Human Rights Watch has expressed concern about the crackdown, saying, quote, "Instead of protecting Salvadorans, this broad state of emergency is a recipe for disaster that puts their rights at risk," unquote. A federal jury in Colorado has awarded $14 million to 12 people who were injured by Denver police during protests in 2020, calling for racial justice following the police killing of George Floyd. The plaintiffs included a man who suffered a fractured skull and bleeding in his brain after police shot him in the head with a projectile. President Biden signed into law a bill making lynching a federal hate crime. The legislation was named after Emmett Till, the 14-year-old Black teenager who was brutally abducted, tortured, and killed in Mississippi in 1955 after he allegedly whistled at a white woman in a store. Speakers at Tuesday's bill signing included Michelle Duster, the great-granddaughter of Ida B. Wells, the legendary anti-lynching journalist.
Since my great-grandmother's visit to the White House 124 years ago, there have been over 200 attempts to get legislation enacted. But we finally stand here today, generations later, to witness this historic moment of President Biden signing the Emmett Till anti-lynching bill into law.
On Tuesday, the United Nations marked the International Day of Remembrance of the Victims of Slavery and the Transatlantic Slave Trade. Nicole Hannah-Jones, the creator of the New York Times groundbreaking 1619 Project, addressed the UN General Assembly.
It is time for the nations that engaged in and profited from the transatlantic slave trade to do what is right and what is just. It is time for them to make reparations to the descendants of chattel slavery in the Americas. This is our global truth, the truth we as human beings understand with stark clarity. There can be no atonement if there is no repair.
News: California is moving ahead with its plan to become the first state to offer reparations. On Tuesday, a state task force voted to limit reparations to the descendants of free and enslaved Black people who were in the United States in the 19th century. By a 5-4 vote, the task force rejected calls to offer reparations to all Black people, regardless of when they came to the United States. The prominent Indian journalist Rana Ayub was blocked Tuesday from flying out of Mumbai. She was scheduled to fly to London to give a speech about the intimidation of women journalists. Ayub has faced severe repercussions for openly criticizing Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, including the freezing of her bank account. YouTube has deleted the entire archive of On Contact, an Emmy-nominated television show hosted by Chris Hedges. The Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist hosted the show for 6 years on RT America, a news channel funded by the Russian government that recently closed down. In a new article, Hedges writes, quote, "If this happens to me, it can happen to you, to any critic anywhere who challenges the dominant narrative," Chris Hedges wrote. Workers at the publishing giant Condé Nast are unionizing with the News Guild of New York. The new Condé Nast union will represent over 500 workers at Vogue, Vanity Fair, GQ, Bon Appetit, and other publications. In other labor news, workers at a Starbucks in Knoxville, Tennessee, have narrowly voted to become the first unionized Starbucks in the South. The company is disputing one ballot in a move that could alter the election result. In sports news, a deal has been approved by New York officials to spend a record-breaking $850 million in public subsidies to help the Buffalo Bills build a new football stadium. The deal includes $600 million from the state of New York and $250 million from Erie County. The Buffalo Bills are owned by the family of the multi-billionaire Terry Pegula, who made his fortune in the fracking industry. New York Governor Kathy Hochul's husband could benefit from the deal. He's a top executive for the hospitality firm, which sells concessions at Bills games. And the longtime activist Robert Rabin has died in Puerto Rico. He was founding member of the Committee for the Rescue and Development of Vieques. He spent 6 months in prison for participating in the mass civil disobedience campaign that helped pressure the U.S. Navy to end its bombing exercises in Vieques, a separate island 8 miles east of Puerto Rico and a municipality of the Commonwealth. Rabin spoke to Democracy Now! In 2013.
The people of Vieques and the Puerto Rican nation in the archipelago and in the diaspora, with help from thousands of people throughout the world, peace-loving people, without firing a single shot, defeated the most powerful military force in history. But 10 years later, we continue to suffer the effects of the toxic legacy, highest cancer case rates in all of Puerto Rico.
Robert Rabin died on Monday of cancer. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan. The United Nations says more than 4 million refugees have now fled Ukraine as Russia's invasion nears its 6th week. On Tuesday, Russia announced plans to, quote, fundamentally cut back military operations near Kyiv and the city of Chernihiv. But the claim was greeted by deep skepticism from Ukraine. Officials in Chernihiv say Russian forces carried out strikes throughout the night while air raid sirens repeatedly went off in Kyiv. On Tuesday, at least 12 people died and 33 were injured in the southern city of Mykolaiv after a Russian rocket hit a government building, leaving a gaping hole in the 9-story structure. Meanwhile, Human Rights Watch has accused Russia of using banned anti-personnel landmines in the eastern Kharkiv region. This comes as the outlines of a possible peace deal emerged Tuesday from talks held in Istanbul, Turkey. Ukrainian negotiators said Ukraine has offered to become a neutral country and remain nuclear-free in exchange for security guarantees. But Ukrainian officials said a deal could only be reached once Russia withdraws its forces. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky addressed the negotiations in a televised address Tuesday night.
Yes, we can call the signals we hear from the negotiating platform positive, but these signals do not drown out the blows of Russian shells. Of course, we see all the risks. Of course, we see no reason to trust the words of certain representatives of a state that continues to fight for our destruction. Ukrainians are not naive people. Ukrainians have already learned, both during these 34 days of invasion and over the past 8 years of the war in Donbass, that only a concrete result can be trusted. The facts, if they change on our earth.
Well, for more, we go to Ukraine, where we're joined outside of Kyiv by Peter Zamayev, the director of the Eurasia Democracy Initiative. Peter, welcome back to Democracy Now! If you can explain what's happening,
Amy,
on the ground, but also respond to what look like the outlines of a peace deal.
Well, I mean, we're seeing this campaign of terror that Vladimir Putin has unleashed against the entire country of Ukraine that's continuing, you know, indiscriminate bombardments of civilian areas and strikes on critical infrastructure objects such as oil depots, transportation hubs, you know, and roads and railways. It is clear that Vladimir Putin remains to be, you know, hell-bent on creating as much misery as he can in Ukraine, also, you know, with the view of increasing the outflow of Ukrainians, you know, out west to Poland and other European countries in order to create chaos there. Vladimir Putin, you know, we've been hearing signals that the Russian Federation, the army, may be considering dislocating or relocating its main forces towards the east of the country, the Donbass. Yesterday they announced that they would be withdrawing many of the troops, the bulk of the troops, from the Chernihiv and Kyiv areas. You know, the Pentagon and British defense ministry have confirmed that Russia has pretty much depleted its fighting force in the area of Kyiv. It's simply not sufficient to continue, you know, entertaining any plans of a takeover of the city of 4 million people with a large area. And so I think this is being dictated by facts on the ground. I would also say that Ukrainians remain very, very skeptical about Vladimir Putin's true intentions. We saw a few days before the invasion on February 24th, after the Russians announced they would be pulling back all the troops, a few days later, they struck. So we're very skeptical that this is not just a smokescreen to allow Russians to regroup and to try to take Kyiv a second time.
And Peter, while the Russians have clearly been held back in Kyiv, their troops have made significant progress in the south and eastern ends of the country. I'm wondering what your sense is of what could happen in any kind of negotiated settlement in terms of those eastern and southern territories that they're already occupying.
Yes, indeed. They are close to completing the so-called land bridge that would connect the occupied territory of the Donbass, which has been occupied since 2014, with the Crimea. The battle is raging over Mariupol. Mariupol has still not fallen. And so the larger strategy, it seems that Vladimir Putin is going to try to divide the country into two along the Dnieper River, sort of creating these, like, it's been compared to like the North versus South Korea scenario. That's going to be a tall order, once again, for Vladimir Putin to achieve, considering that the Russian army currently is highly demoralized, has significant supply issues, logistics, etc. But it doesn't mean he's not going to try. Whatever happens, if Vladimir Putin has to have some kind of a credible victory to present to his population, to his elites, in order to continue staying in power. It is a kind of a truism now that Russian leaders, if they lose a war badly, go on to lose power. A very important date is coming up in the Russian calendar, May 9th, the victory day, the day of victory over the Nazi Germany. But Vladimir Putin is going to want to present some sort of a victory, announce some sort of a victory during the parade. And that victory may be, if he conquers the rest of the Donbass and try, and once again, if he succeeds in dividing Ukraine in two, which I think is going to be very difficult for him to do.
And what is your sense of the reaction of Ukrainians to President Zelensky's apparent agreement that Ukraine's neutrality could be a part of a settlement and, in essence, not joining NATO, which was originally what the principal issue that Russia was raising before it invaded was?
Well, I think from the get-go, for Vladimir Putin, this expansion of NATO has been a red herring. He's used it to justify his attempt to grab land. That's 19th century war of conquest that he is prosecuting in Ukraine. So once again, I think it's not really what Vladimir Putin is after. I don't think he ever considered Ukraine to be a security threat to Russia. And so the Ukrainians are willing to meet some of the Russian demands. The neutrality status is being seriously considered. A no to NATO is going to be seriously considered. Obviously, Zelensky does not have the kind of mandate. It's not Russia. And Zelensky is not Putin. He's going to have to submit this to the population in some kind of a referendum and also receive ironclad guarantees from Western partners, including members of the Security Council of the UN, to keep Ukraine well protected. Demilitarization of Ukraine, as Vladimir Putin announced was his goal in Ukraine, is simply not feasible. Ukraine cannot remain demilitarized. You know, it has to be well protected. But I think, once again, Ukrainians are very much ready to negotiate. But the question is if Vladimir Putin continues to cling to his obsession to try to control all of Ukraine and control its politics and to install a puppet regime.
Based on the reports in the Russian media to the Russian people, it looks like he will claim victory by consolidating attacks in the east and really focus on talking about Donbass and Crimea. And Peter, if you can talk about the history of these two places, and has the attitude of Ukrainians changed as a result of this overall invasion of their country?
Well, indeed. I mean, if we're talking about Crimea and the Donbass and what Russia has done since 2014, it's not been a success story, to say the least. You know, even though the population there is pretty brainwashed, obviously, Russians disconnected immediately Ukrainian TV channels and, started bombarding folks there with their propaganda. Folks living just across the border from the areas, they have seen what it is like living in the sort of mini gulags. That's essentially what you're dealing with. And that explains the unwillingness of Ukrainians living across the border, Russian-speaking Ukrainians, in like Mariupol, for example, or Kharkiv, to greet Russians as liberators. This is something Vladimir Putin counted on going in. We've all heard about this scenario, like being greeted with flowers. They packed parade uniforms. And we're expecting within 3 days to parade down the main drag of Kiev. That hasn't happened. Like I say, it's been kind of a you're hearing this sort of saying in Ukraine now that Vladimir Putin, the last month has killed the last Russian in Ukraine. No one wants to be a part of what Russia has to offer. Russia essentially is running on a very nihilistic message, if there is such a message, and there is none. It's sowing destruction. It's preaching complete, ignorance. It's creating alternative reality in the minds of the bulk of the Russian population, and Ukrainians do not want to be a part of that.
You grew up, Peter Zamayev, in Donetsk. What will happen to these two areas, Crimea and Donetsk, in addition to the Ukraine promising, as Juan just pointed out, something that Putin was demanding before the invasion, which is that they remain neutral, that they not become a part of NATO. I think so there are some broad outlines of a discussion of Crimea won't be dealt with for the next 15 years.
Well, that's precisely the sticking point. Vladimir Putin knows that Zelensky is going to be negotiating in a position between a rock and a hard place. He does not have the popular mandate to just sign off unilaterally on, let's say, recognizing Russia's sovereignty over the Donbas or Crimea. But a formula is now being searched for, such as freezing this issue for 15 years and entering this long period of negotiations. And that is something that may be doable, simply because, truth to be told, Ukraine does not have the strength right now, the requisite force to liberate those areas. Having said that, we all know that once Vladimir Putin goes, there's a good chance that these areas will revert to Ukraine. And regardless of what happens, the severe sanctions regime and the hundreds of billion dollars of Russia's sovereign wealth fund that have been frozen in on Western bank accounts will only be unfrozen, and sanctions will only be lifted once Russia leaves the last remaining inch of Ukraine's territory. That is also something to consider.
Peter Zamayev, we want to thank you for being with us, director of the Eurasia Democracy Initiative, speaking to us from just outside Ukraine's capital, Kyiv. Stay safe. Next up, the U.S. says it plans to welcome 100,000 Ukrainian refugees at the same time it's preparing to detain a surge of asylum seekers from places like Haiti at the U.S.-Mexico border. We'll look at the contrast in treatment. Stay with us.
No closer to where I belong.
And how many trails have I gone down for no reason? Just to learn I can't leave myself behind. And the only devil I've ever seen was in the mirror. And the only enemy I know is in my mind. Won't you tell me
how long must I pay
off? Learning to Lose by Margot Price, featuring Willie Nelson. And Willie, our condolences on the death of your sister, Bobby Nelson. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Immigration officials say they're preparing to detain a surge of people traveling to the U.S.-Mexico border to seek humanitarian relief. In response to pressure from human rights advocates, today the CDC is expected to end the Trump-era pandemic border restriction called Title 42 that allowed authorities to deport asylum seekers without due process or reviewing their claims. Just 6 months ago, the world was shocked by images of mounted Border Patrol agents chasing, grabbing, whipping Haitian asylum seekers held back at the U.S.-Mexico border in Texas as they were blocked under the pretext of Title 42, under the pretext of the pandemic. A new report by the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights and the Haitian Bridge Alliance documents the full scope of the abuses Haitians faced while they were held in a makeshift camp near the border under a bridge in Del Rio, Texas. They describe being subjected to violence, racial slurs, and intimidation, and denied sufficient access to food, water, and medical care. This comes as the United States has just announced it'll welcome up to 100,000 Ukrainian refugees fleeing the Russian invasion. When President Biden visited with Ukrainian refugees in Poland this past weekend, he was shown embracing a Ukrainian child. Gerline Joseph, executive director of the Haitian Bridge Alliance, tweeted this in response. The amount of pain that comes with seeing this beautiful picture is unbearable. The well-deserved love, kindness, dignity, compassion, protection that's given to this little girl is never afforded to little black Haitian girls at POTUS's doorsteps. Trump said it. Biden proved it, Gerline wrote. Gerline Joseph now joins us, along with the award-winning journalist Maria Hinojosa. They've both worked closely with Haitian migrants at what Maria calls the moving border. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! Gerline Joseph, let's begin with you and that tweet, the comparison of how Ukrainian refugees are beautifully welcomed around the world and now in the United States, and what's happening with Haitians and others on the U.S.-Mexico border trying to come in.
Good morning. Thank you so much, Amy, for having us and for highlighting the realities and contrast between how people are being received along borders, whether at the U.S.-Mexico border or in Ukraine. We all saw when it just happened how Black people who were trying to escape Ukraine as well were pushed back and not afforded protection. So really, I want to make it clear that we stand 100% with the people of Ukraine, and we agree 100% with the president and the administration for welcoming the people of Ukraine. We want to make sure that they are protected. But what we are saying is, why is it that when it comes for people of color, Black and brown people, we must continue to push and beg to validate our humanity? And as I mentioned, Amy, in that post, the picture really warmed my heart to see how the president was holding that little girl, smiling. At the same time, I couldn't pass the fact that they are really chasing and weeping and turning away little Black girls and little Black boys at the U.S., at the U.S.-Mexico border. So really calling for us to welcome all people with dignity, regardless of our skin color, where we are from, because the same care and compassion and love that is afforded to this beautiful little girl must be afforded to those beautiful little kids that are also of Haitian descent or Mexican descent who are fleeing extreme conditions in their home countries. And I can tell you, today, there are deportations happening to Haiti, and we are seeing continued expulsion and deportations to Haiti, a country that we all know are dealing with extreme condition, political turmoil. Yesterday, you know, the vice president, the prime minister in Haiti calling for help because they cannot even control what they are dealing with, still dealing with the assassination of the president, the aftermath of the earthquake, the following storm, climate change, really forcing people to leave home. So what we are asking and what we are saying is, for our little Black girls, little Black boys who are in search of safety, literally fleeing the same conditions that the Ukrainian people are fleeing from home, may not be a war from Russia, but a war within their own country. So we are asking for the same welcoming to be given to those who are in search of protection. And as you mentioned from the report, we have 43 people describing the extreme cruelty and abuse that was that they witnessed and also were victim of. People, most of them have been deported or expelled, and some of them were also pushed back to Haiti, including the young men we saw being grabbed by the officer in uniform, really mistreating and abusing them. And today, close to 21,000 people have been deported by President Biden.
And I'd like to bring Maria Hinojosa into the conversation. Maria, I wanted to ask you, if you could talk about your experiences in reporting on the continuing now several years of reporting on the problems at the U.S. border, but also this, not only the racial aspect of U.S. Policy when it comes to asylum seekers, but there's also a political aspect. As we know, for instance, during the 1980s, Nicaraguans were welcomed, granted asylum, while Salvadorans and Guatemalans were denied asylum by the United States because the United States wanted to expose and condemn the Nicaraguan, the Sandinistas at the time. I'm wondering your sense of how this is playing out, both the racial aspects and the political aspects now.
So, Juan, it's great to be with you, and Amy and Gerlaine as well. Look, Juan, it hasn't been years that I've been covering this. As you, I've been covering this for decades. Decades. And, you know, when I think about everything that Gerlaine just talked about, the point is that this country, the United States, has a narrative that it lives by that says that we are an immigrant-loving country and that we love and accept refugees. And what we are saying, journalists, activists on the ground, is that that narrative is not true. And what we are seeing is, in fact, it's ugly to say it, but white supremacy in the context of refugees and desperate people. So what did I see, Juan, when I was down in December in Mexico and then in Colombia on the border with Panama? Juan, you know, I have reported about this, again, for decades, but I had never had the chance to be on a caravan. And when I got to the caravan, you know, the United States, the mainstream media, our colleagues talk about the caravan as this scary, frightful thing. In fact, Donald Trump raised this whole specter of the caravan. But how many U.S. government officials, human rights officials have been with the caravan so that they can see what I saw? It is a caravan of love. It is a caravan of solidarity. It is the place when you are traveling through Mexico, if you are Black, as increasingly the migrants and refugees are, the caravan is the only place that you will feel safe. These immigrants, migrants, and refugees are the smartest people when they decide to join a caravan. The fact that the United States mainstream media and the government has chosen to portray the caravans as filled with scary, terrible people who are going to force their way onto the border. It's not true. That's not what they're doing. They are exactly as the Ukrainian refugees are right now. They are desperate, and they are looking to a country that says that they will accept them. Now, just very quickly, last night I was finally able to get in touch with Udi, who is from Nigeria. And he left me a message last night. I said, just bring me up to date. He did finally make it into the United States, but he was held for 4 months in a detention camp. This is a young man who, when I saw him in the jungle, he was like, I got this. We're going to do this. I'm going to, you know, the message he left me said, I don't even want to think about what I've been through. It has been so terrible, so horrific. And the worst part of his travels has been being in the United States in an immigrant detention camp and the disrespect that he had to feel. And finally, as Gerlaine was saying, what this government is doing, a government that says that it appreciates refugees, that has a president that will hug a little Ukrainian girl, what they did to the Familia Felix in our story was that they lied to them. And the U.S. government, Border Patrol and ICE, told them that they were going to be taken to Miami. And when the doors of the plane opened, they had been lied to. They were sent back to Haiti, a country they haven't lived in for over a decade. So the pleas that we have, you know, people say, oh, Maria, you're so obsessed with migrants and refugees. That's because you're an immigrant yourself. You're so Mexican. And it's like, no, I'm obsessed with the capacity that this country has for inhumanity and specifically watching how that inhumanity is being thrust on people who are Black and simply seeking refuge.
Maria, I mean, the fact that you gave a voice to people is what the mainstream media is doing right now with Ukrainians. It is a model of how all refugees should be treated. So I wanted to go to your reports for the series you did where you met this Haitian family, the family Felix, in the Mexican state of Oaxaca. as they made their way north with a migrant caravan. The Felix family, as you said, fled Haiti over a decade ago after the horrendous earthquake that killed some 300,000 people. They resettled in Brazil, told them they were once again forced to flee, this time to the U.S.-Mexico border. So this is a clip from Latino USA called The Moving Border, Even Further South, where the family tells you about their experience crossing through the Darien Gap, a notoriously dangerous, dense jungle that stretches across the Colombian and Panamanian border.
Comemos leche en polvo y chocolate en polvo. Así. Y bebé al agua del río. Vimos mucha persona muerta.
Sí, los vimos. Nos vimos como tres.
The Felix's children tell me they saw dead bodies in the jungle, people who looked like them. But they had to keep going. Eventually, they were detained by Panamanian police and sent back to Colombia. So they had to do the unthinkable, start all over again and cross back into the Darien jungle.
So in January, over 2 months after you said goodbye to the Felix family in Oaxaca, you received the message from the mother asking you to call her.
Buenos días.
Videlín.
Amor.
Ay, Videlín, ¿qué pasó?
Yo no sé.
¿Qué pasó?
Yo no sé.
¿Qué cosa más horrible, Videlín? ¿Qué cosa más horrible?
Llegamos allá, duramos como 15 días en la prisión y de ahí nos colocaron en avión en Texas y nos regresaron aquí en Haití.
Videlín and her entire family is now in Haiti. 10 years after she escaped the devastation of an earthquake that destroyed everything that she had worked for, after birthing her two youngest children in the Dominican Republic, after living in South America for years, after crossing the Darien jungle twice, she and her family made it to the U.S., but 15 days later, the Biden administration deported them back to Haiti.
That's Maria Hinojosa's report from called The Moving Border. It is so moving, Maria. And if you can talk about what the actions have meant, because as you talk about this caravan of hope and of love, it's the immigrant rights movement that has forced this action that's expected to be announced today, ending Title 42, which has used the pandemic as a way to prevent so many immigrants. We certainly haven't heard this in the case of Ukraine, but coming into the United States or being detained once they do.
You know, Amy, what I'm hoping, I have not so much of it. This was a perfect opportunity, in fact, for the Biden administration to completely switch everything up. This is a moment where the Biden administration could say, we're changing everything now because we are going to be committed to what we say we are. This is a moment where the Biden administration could not only get rid of Title 42, stop MPP, reorganize the Border Patrol, because we all saw with our own eyes Border Patrol officials on horses with whips on black people. So we cannot be gaslit upon what we are living. Sadly, it looks like the Biden administration is more interested in appeasing to people who are afraid of migrants and refugees and black people. And our job as journalists is to say, look at the treatment of Ukrainian refugees, look at the treatment of Honduran, Salvadoran, Guatemalan, Haitian, African migrants and refugees. And there has to be one way to treat all humanity. So I'm feeling quite desperate. You know, Videlín and I are in touch. She's desperate to get help. She says that now that she's in Haiti, she's terrified for her two young girls because it's so unsafe. So, Amy, for me personally, as a human being, this is ripping into my heart. As a journalist, you know, I'm just like, I'm going to keep at it. I'm not going to stop. And I'm going to demand accountability because what we are seeing is not just the suffering of Ukrainian refugees, but people on our side of the continent. And they need love. And they need that hug from Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. Both of them to say we welcome you. We see you and we welcome you. And thank you, Amy and Juan, for recognizing the journalism and for allowing me to get a little emotional because, hey, if you lose all your emotion, then what good are we as journalists?
Juan, we aren't able to hear you. Juan?
Sorry about that. Gerlene, I wanted to ask you, this mistreatment not only of Haitians, but you've been noticing also of Cameroon migrants who are seeking asylum in the United States. I wonder if you could talk about that as well.
Thank you so much, Juan. And thank you so much, Maria, for really bringing the reality of what's happening. Looking into continued contrast and parallel when it comes to the different treatment of Black migrants and European migrants, frankly, we have been fighting for over 2 years to get TPS for Cameroon, a country that has been into 5 armed conflicts and really seeing how the mistreatment of Cameroonians in immigration prison. We were literally forced to create the first Black Immigrants Bail Fund because we had a $50,000 bail to pay for Cameroonian young men who fled Cameroon to come here. And we've been asking for TPS for 2 years. And we've been begging President Biden and Vice President Harris, Susan Rice, to please allow TPS for Cameroon so that they can be free, at least be protected from deportation. And they have refused. And we see within a week, TPS was provided for Ukraine. That is why we continue to push and ask for TPS for Cameroon. We cannot wait any longer to make sure that equity is a part of our immigration system, that people from Cameroon are receiving TPS as soon as possible. And we commend the administration for highlighting and validating the lives of Ukrainians and the lives of our Afghan community. But it is past due for TPS to be provided for Cameroon. And what we say is protection delay is protection denied. And we, again, seeing right now how we have allowed exemption for Ukrainians and Russians that are coming at the U.S.-Mexico border. Juan and Amy, I was there last Monday really trying to highlight the damage of Title 42. And I clearly remember in 2020, April 2020, when the Haitian Bridge Alliance sent the first letter starting a campaign to ask then-President Trump to end Title 42 because it did not bear any water as to why they will really put Title 42 in place simply to block asylum seekers from getting protection. And today we are hoping and really pushing and demanding as a community, as a movement, for President Biden and the CDC to put an end to Title 42 and make sure it's never used against people at the U.S.-Mexico border, specifically Black and brown people, because we clearly see that we are allowing Ukrainians and other Europeans to access the process at the U.S.-Mexico border, while at the same time making sure that Haitians are not afforded the same protection. So we really are calling on President Biden to highlight the fact that, yes, President Trump then said that he did not want people from S-hole countries such as Haiti and many African countries, but he will welcome people from Europe. And we see clearly that the things that President Trump said, President Biden is proving to us as a people that is the reality. We are willing and able and ready to welcome immigrants as long as they are not Black and brown.
And I wanted to ask Maria this. You mentioned earlier you're a proud Mexican American. I'm sorry, Maria's dropped. Let me go back to Gerlene. Gerlene, in terms of what you believe the Biden administration needs to do immediately, beyond what's happening now with Title 42, what are the next steps that you think the administration needs to take?
The next step is really to look into how do we provide access and safety to all people in search of freedom. We as a movement, service providers, advocates, on the ground at the U.S.-Mexico border, we are ready and willing to help and support and work with the President Biden and the entire administration to put in place ways for people to access safety. And we want to make sure that we really look into our immigration system in an equity lens. How do we make sure that what we are seeing right now is never repeated? And we want President Biden to understand that we on the ground, we are serving the community. We are the people in need of protection, making sure that we create a system that will be afforded to all people to be able to get that protection. And we are also asking them to stop pushing the border. Right now, we are seeing border not only at the U.S.-Mexico border, but going all the way to Panama, as Maria mentioned earlier. We are seeing, because of policies that are being put in place to completely continue to dismantle any avenues for people seeking safety, we need to change the system. And what I say is that if the system doesn't serve the people, what is the point of it? Our goal is to make sure.
I just wanted to thank you so much for being with us, because in our next segment, we're going to go global with this. As you talk about Cameroonian refugees, as we hear about Nigerian refugees, the same thing, by the way, has happened to those students who are in Ukraine fleeing with all the other Ukrainians, the millions of Ukrainians. And some of them were detained in places like Poland and Estonia as their white compatriots in Ukraine were celebrated in each of these countries. Gerline Joseph, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Executive Director of the Haitian Bridge Alliance, and Maria Hinojosa, award-winning journalist and host of Latino USA. We're going to link to Maria's series, The Moving Border, even further south, and of course continue to look at this issue. Next up, we look at the conditions African migrants face trying to reach Europe. Inside Libyan detention centers. Stay with us. If I Had a Heart by Fever Ray. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As the world embraces Ukrainians fleeing the Russian invasion and presents a model for how refugees should be welcomed, we look now at how refugees from Africa face a very different story. The Western world's largely turned its back on the horrific conditions African migrants face inside Libyan detention centers. And this is the focus of a new book titled My Fourth Time We Drowned: Seeking Refuge on the World's Deadliest Migration Route. It's just out this week. We're joined by Sally Hayden, its author, Africa correspondent for the Irish Times. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Sally. Can you lay out how a single message to you from an Eritrean refugee being held in a Libyan detention center led to your interviews with hundreds of refugees and migrants who were fleeing to Europe but detained in Libya?
Yeah, sure. And thank you for having me. So like you said, in August 2018, I got a Facebook message. It just said, "Hi, Sister Sally, I need your help. I'm under, I think something like detention in Libyan prison." They said a Libyan prison. And if you have time, I'll tell you all the story. And I was kind of skeptical because I didn't really know where this had come from, why I had been contacted, like how someone in a prison would have my name or a phone even. But I messaged back and I said, "Okay, tell me about it." So what this person said was there were 500 of them, men, women and children. They were in effectively a detention center. They had all pretty much tried to reach Europe by crossing the Mediterranean Sea and been intercepted by the Libyan Coast Guard. And at that point, forced back to detention and locked up indefinitely with no legal recourse, no way to get out. And a war had broken out around them. And the guards that had imprisoned them had run away, leaving them with no food and no water. And so this one message basically led me on what's been now nearly 4 years of an investigation. And what I found out was that tens of thousands of people, I mean, to date now, since 2017, around 90,000 people have been caught at sea under what is an EU policy which supports the Libyan Coast Guard, because under international law, it's illegal for European boats to return people to a place where their lives are in danger. And so their lives are in danger in Libya. But if the EU supports the Libyan Coast Guard, then Libyan boats do the intercepting. That's not illegal under international law. So it's effectively a circumnavigation of international law. And yet, like, thousands of people, tens of thousands of people have been locked up in detention centers that Pope Francis, among many others, have compared to concentration camps, where every sort of abuse happens. And the situation is absolutely horrific. It's ongoing.
And Sally, could you talk about the role of technology and social media in what is happening with many of these refugees?
Yeah, I mean, social media is obviously the way that they contacted me. And what happened after that initial message, I actually started also posting the messages on social media, on Twitter, in a Twitter thread, and that ended up being viewed millions of times. And the result of that was that my name and my number and my contact details were passed around many detention centers. So I suddenly had many refugees in many different detention centers sending me messages on WhatsApp, on Facebook, on Twitter. But social media, I mean, it's kind of has good and bad aspects, but, you know, very like life-changing aspects. What I found out was that, for example, when smugglers detain people in Libya, they're now crowdfunding. So they'll post photos of people who are being tortured online so that they can crowdfund larger and larger ransoms. It's really contributed to how captivity is being monetized. So it's kind of raising the cost, but it's also giving people a lifeline to try and be able to escape these situations.
And could you talk about how the what the situation with Libya and in terms of refugees is like after the overthrow of Gaddafi and the NATO-backed bombing campaign that occurred in Libya, in terms of the EU utilizing Libya as a gatekeeper to Africa?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure many people know after the 2011 revolution, Libya has been in turmoil. It's effectively a country that's run between militias, like many different militias. There are multiple governments. There hasn't really been a stable leadership since that revolution. And of course, you had like smugglers, human smugglers taking advantage of that in the beginning. So there were a lot of refugees and migrants who come to Libya to try and cross into Europe. But what has happened since 2017, particularly since the European Union is now spending hundreds of millions of euro on trying to effectively stop migration from Libya, that has turned into a monetization of captivity. So it's more likely now that people like refugees are being moved around different detention centers or else even smuggling gangs. And there's kind of like cycles there. It's not so clear cut always, you know, what is an official, you know, government associated detention center and what is something being run by smugglers. I mean, they all can work together, and that includes the Coast Guard as well. The Coast Guard is a looser entity than you would believe, but still the EU continues to work with them.
Sally, we just have a minute to go. Explain the title, My Fourth Time We Drowned.
It actually comes from a quote by a Somali refugee who's now in Europe. And he was speaking about the amount of times that they try to cross the sea before reaching safety. He tried three times when he was intercepted. The fourth time, two of his family members actually died. That's what the We Drowned refers to. The fifth time, he alone made it to safety. But I mean, he even says himself, like, he feels like part of him has drowned by going through this process. You know, part of him is dead because of the suffering he's witnessed and the family members that he's lost.
Well, Sally, we're going to do part two of this interview where we're going to talk about how actually the war in Ukraine will affect famine in Africa, and also talk about the role of organizations like the European Union in using Libya for these detention camps, what some have called concentration camps for refugees fleeing poverty and persecution. Sally Hayden, Africa correspondent for the Irish Times, her new book, My Fourth Time We Drowned: Seeking Refuge on the World's Deadliest Migration Route. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Has an immediate job opening for a news writer-producer. Visit democracynow.org for details. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
No, I can't stay, Renee. I'm sorry.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
You're listening to Away with Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. On our Facebook group, Arlene Westhoven wrote, "After certain gatherings, my family sometimes said, 'I haven't had so much fun since the horse kicked father.'"
Poor dad.
Yeah, and that reminded me of the one that I heard growing up, which was, "I haven't had so much fun since the hogs ate my little brother up."
No. They would, too. Hogs can be mean.
Yeah, you know that from experience, right?
Absolutely.
A lot of people chimed in with their own versions that they'd heard. Ken Jones said that his family said, "I haven't had so much fun since the barn burnt down." And Sarah Bradley said, "I haven't laughed so hard since Maggie fell out of the hearse."
And these are all usually said when you didn't really think it was funny.
You know, maybe it's sarcastic. Maybe it's ironic.
Or both. It's sometimes genuinely said and sometimes sarcastically said.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we haven't had so much fun since the last time you called us. So pick up the phone, 877-929-9673. That's toll-free in the U.S. and Canada. Everyone else can talk to us on Twitter at WAYWORD or email us words@waywardradio.org. Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi, this is Dexter Strong calling from Huntsville, Alabama.
Hi, Dexter. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What would you like to talk with us about?
So we got married. I got married about a year and a half ago, and my wife is from the Midwest. She's from Minnesota, and she calls our conversations a rhetorical adventure because they are littered with Southern idioms and phrases that she just never heard. And I sprinkle in Southern vernacular and Black vernacular into all our conversations, like, indiscriminately, and she just has never heard many of the phrases that I use. And once, this was early when we were dating, she sneezed, and instinctively I said, "Scat, cat." And she looked at me with this puzzled face. She said, What did you just say to me?" I said, "Well, scat, cat." And it's a phrase that I'd always grown up with. My mom, ever since I was young, each time I sneezed, she said "scat cat" more frequently than she said "bless you." And I'm wondering where that phrase comes from.
Uh-huh. And did you both grow up in Alabama then?
My mom grew up in Shelbyville, Tennessee, which is about 70 to 80 miles northeast of Huntsville, which is kind of like in the Tennessee Valley right on the border. Outside of my mom, I have never heard anybody else say that. My dad didn't say it growing up. But my mom always said that. I'm wondering where that phrase comes from.
Well, Dexter, this makes a lot of sense to us because it's pretty much across the southern United States. And there are lots of different versions of it. And you just say scat cat, right?
Yep, scat cat.
Yep. But there are lots and lots of different versions of this. There's scat cat, your tail's on fire. Scat there, your son bit your tail off. Scat Tom, your tail is on fire. Scat cat, get your tail out of the gravy. And scat cat, get your tail out of the butter. There are a whole lot of variations of this, different elaborations of this expression. We're not really sure where it comes from, although it might have to do with that old superstition that a sneeze is some kind of evil spirit leaving your body, you know? And you just want that thing to get out of there.
Wow. Are all of those phrases different responses to sneezes that you just enumerated, all of those?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That is interesting. I always assumed that it had something to do with cats being, I don't know, something that people were allergic to?
Well, that's another possibility for sure.
I never thought that my mom was kind of symbolically warding off an evil spirit every time I sneezed.